Oh, hello. There we go. Hello and welcome to my talk. Today's talk is Good Habits Gone Wild. That wasn't technically in the program, but I thought it was kind of fun. But it's actually called Good JavaScript Habits for C# Developers. Most of this content was based on a series of articles that I wrote for enterprisejQuery.com that I learned on actually one of my first contracts with them. I do some front-end architecture reviews for companies, and it was a company that their background was C#, and they were writing JavaScript on a new project, and they're actually learning the language as they're making this project. And as I reviewed their code, I saw the same mistakes that I've made over and over again, and I figured, hey, this might be a good talk to help people that come from our background, which is C#. Also, the concepts do apply to other languages like Java and C++, so it's not necessarily C#, but you can still provide value. My name is Elijah Manor. Like I said, I work for Apintu, which is a company dedicated to jQuery. We do consulting, reviews, training, etc. I am a Microsoft MVP and an insider. You could email me with any questions at elijah.manor@gmail.com. I'm on Twitter. You might have seen me. If not, if you follow me, you might unfollow me because I tweet a lot. But anyway, my blog's elijahmanor.com. So like I said, this material came from a series of blog posts. You're welcome to see them. I know sometimes videos are nice to get the content initially, but sometimes you need to go back and see some textual information to quickly find what you're looking for. So the first thing we're going to look at is most C# developers are used to, true and false when they're doing if statements or conditional logic. But in JavaScript, it's quite a bit different. And if you don't understand that there's something called a falsy value, things could get confusing quickly. So what we're going to look at here is there are 6 different values in JavaScript that will evaluate to a falsy value. And it's really important to know these, because if you don't, like I said, things are going to get really confusing. So obviously false is false, and you're probably used to that, and that makes sense. Null is false, that, it's a little bit different, but that makes sense too. In JavaScript, there's something called undefined, which the variable's not defined yet. Well, that's also falsy. This one kind of confuses people. An empty string is falsy, so that's quite a bit different from what you're used to in C#. Zero is falsy, and if you're a raw C programmer, that kind of makes sense to you. And there's something called not a number, that does that well. So first of all, just remember those, and things will make a lot more sense. This next point is going to piggyback off that idea of falsy values. And it's basically not testing and setting your default values correctly. So a C# person would probably write code like this over and over again. Some string's not null, and it has a length greater than 0, because the worst thing in the world is to have the object reference null, error, the big blow-up page. And you don't want to do that, I find myself littering my code with this over and over again. And it's become so common that the .NET framework, has a is null or empty method to kind of do this for you, and now it has an is null or empty or white space. So it's a very common thing to do, so they're trying to make it easier. But you don't want to really be writing this code in JavaScript, or you don't have to. This is just if you see this in someone's JavaScript code, there's a high probability that they're probably a C# developer or Java. What you can do in JavaScript is just say some string. And based on those 6 falsy values, by doing this syntax, it checks for undefined, it checks for null, it checks that it has a value, because empty string is null. So it does all those things in this very terse syntax. And this is what the syntax you'll see in JavaScript libraries. If you opened up jQuery source, you'd see this more common technique. Now, there are cases where you might actually want to check for null, and obviously in that case, you might want to do this a little bit differently. But in most cases, this is a syntax that you would want to start using. Another common thing is in C#, you want to test if you want to provide a default value for a variable. So something that you might see is, testing it's null, and if it is, then set a default value. Another approach in C# is using the ternary operator. So you might do something like this. But in JavaScript, there's actually, so in C# also there's the double question mark operator. But unfortunately, that's not supported in JavaScript. So the better way is to do something like this. You actually use an OR statement. And what that does is some string, it'll evaluate that, and based on the falsy values, like if it's false or empty string or undefined or not a number, then it'll actually go to the second part of the OR and default the value to the string right here. So this is another common technique you'll see over and over again in your in libraries such as jQuery or Dojo. And it's something that you would probably want to write as well. So the best practice, or something that you probably want to consider doing, is basically learning those six falsy values and just be aware of them and how they might change the structure of your code. And it actually makes things a lot more readable if you don't have to say not equals and length zero and all those things. The next really common and confusing thing is to use the wrong comparison operators. So if you were to write JavaScript, and here's a set of equality operators that I'm doing, 0 is equal to empty string, 0 is equal to 0, a string version, false equals the string version of 0, a bunch of crazy things, like 0 is equal to, tab and character turn. Well, these actually all end up evaluating to true. And if you were to look at this from a C# perspective, that would be like, that's insanity. How does this language even work? And it's no wonder that people who come from our background give JavaScript a bad rap. And because the syntax is so similar, it looks like C#. And so, but it's not. It's more akin to something like F# or a functional language. So there's considerable differences, and it's in your best interest to kind of learn these differences. So what you want to do instead, there's actually a triple equals operator, or comparison operator, that you might not be aware of because that's just a lot of equal signs. And there's another one called a not equals equals. But what this does, let's step back and tell you what the previous one does. Just the standard double equals, what it does is it tries to coerce each side into some kind of a true or false value. And so by doing so, you get some really crazy things. But the triple equals will keep each side of the equals as is. Like, it'll remain the type, and it will compare the types that they are. And so in this case, all these five different cases will all be false, because it makes more sense that 0 would not equal empty string, because that's what you probably meant. So the key takeaway is to always, in most cases, use the triple equals or the not double equals. There are a few cases where you could get away with the other one, but in my preference is to mostly use them, because I know it's always going to do kind of what I expect. Another thing, again, JavaScript looks so much like C# that you'll see developers declaring their arrays and their objects like this, like new object, new array, and those work. There's actually a little overhead by doing that, but the language itself has some literal versions of those. So a better way is to declare a person like this, and this is like an open curly, end curly, and that's considered an object literal, and I'll show you in a second how you can actually create new objects quickly using the syntax. And for an array, you just need to use an open brace and a closed brace, and this is a preferred approach. It's the literal way to declare these things. It's slightly faster, and it usually makes more sense when you use the object versions or the new array. The behavior might not be what you expect, and we'll look into some of those here in a second. So here's how you might create a new object using the curly syntax. And so this is considered an object literal with a first name property, basically, of Elijah, last name, and we could actually declare a function inline immediately. Whereas if you did this before, you'd have to say new object, and then on the next line, you'd have to build that up. So this is a nice way to build your object up quickly. And with an array, you could quickly give it values immediately. Whereas if you said new array, you can't actually define the values immediately. You have to do it on another line. So this is a very terse, very preferred way to do those things. So again, it's the best practice is to use the literal notation. And to try to stay away from the new, definitely don't do new Boolean or new number. Those actually are wrappers around the native type, and that's even more confusing. So you could do new date and some of those things, but the standard types aren't a good idea. So C# developers are used to like a for each statement. You have an array or some kind of collection, and you need to loop over them. There are some gotchas in JavaScript doing this, and let's go look through them. So a bad habit is using, there is like a for in, it's similar to a for each. And so what will happen here, let's look through this code and see why it's kind of confusing. First, we're going to declare our array using the literal syntax, which is the preferred way. We're going to give it the index of 5 value of test, which, okay, you know, that seems fine. And that might seem a little weird to you because if I do the length of the array, it'll be 6, which that sort of makes sense because that's where you put the index. And you could do that in JavaScript, and that's fine. But if you used a for in array to loop over, you'll only get one output, which is the 5th index, which might not be what you're thinking. You might have expected to print out, you know, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but it doesn't do that. For normal arrays, the preferred approach is to use an index and, you know, iterate over it. And so what you get in this case is probably what you expected. It'll print out everything, and the value of each of 0 through 4 will be undefined because obviously you haven't defined what the value of that is. And so this is probably more what you expect to do, and it won't confuse you and make you even hate JavaScript more. And so there's another problem with using the for in array, and that is there's something called a prototype in JavaScript, and my intention is not to explain prototypes in this, but you can kind of think of it like an inheritance. You know, if the object or property is not on your object, it'll go up one level higher and try to see if it's there. And so let's say we have an array here, and then someone adds a variable to the array prototype and gives it a value of a string. That doesn't really make much sense, but the for in statement will actually pick up anything that was on the prototype. So if you added test to index 5, that will print out, but then it'll print out anything on the prototype. Now, jQuery doesn't really add things to native prototypes. Like, if you were to look at an array, it's a clean array. But if you were to look at a language like Dojo, so here's the same code, and here's the output here. I'm going to add a different library, rerun it. Oh, let's see. That's not working. Oh, not Dojo. I meant MooTools. There we go. If you look at the output, and let me try to zoom in. Not only did we get 5 tests, but we got a bunch of functions that it added to the array. Now, these are nice helper functions that, you know, you would be nice to use, like reverse and sort and things that you find really cool. But if you just use a for in, you'll pick these up as well, and your code, you're like, what in the world are these coming from? So let's get out of this. So thankfully, there's a way around this, and we'll look at it in a second. So this is the code that you don't want to do, just a simple for in with your code in the middle. A preferred approach, you have to actually do an if statement inside of it. And so there's the object has something called a hasOwnProperty method, and you pass it the key, which is, you know, the property name or function name, and it will tell you, is this key actually on my object? Because you don't want to do the ones in the prototype. So you're basically only executing your code if it owned that natively, because you don't want to You don't want to bleed in all the mootools functions. And so what that might look like is, here's a sample person constructor. We give it a first name, last name. And then here we're actually adding a prototype to the person. We're adding two new properties, is married and has kids. So what we're going to do is create new two people, John and Linda. And then we're going to have two for loops here. One's a standard for n, not checking, that has own property. And it will print out the first name, last name, and the is married and has kids, which was off the prototype that we defined. But if you actually check that Linda has the own property, it will only print out the things that were actually on the object, so the first name and last name. Now, there are cases that you might actually want to iterate over the things in the prototype, which is fine. Just don't check has own property. But if you want to constrain your for statement to just things that the property has, then make the if statement. So the best practice, the one takeaway, even not knowing what a prototype is, if you have an array, use the for with the indexes. So that's pretty much the takeaway. And then if you have an object, make sure to test the has own property. The next really big confusing thing, and I see this a lot, is misunderstanding scope in JavaScript. Now, as a C# developer, you've probably taken for granted that between curly braces, a variable that's declared in there stays there. Now, in JavaScript, that's not the case. And this could be really confusing if you don't understand that. It's a functional language. So the scope actually is defined between the beginning of the function and the end of the function. You could have if statements all you want inside with curly braces, but that doesn't mean anything when we're talking about scope. So let's look at what this might, some bad things that might happen about this. So here's some code that someone might write. It's an eat function. And we have some bacon. Hopefully, thankfully, you had lunch. Actually, I think some people didn't, so this might be bad. So we have some bacon, and they're hungry. And if they're hungry, then they're declaring a variable inside of the if statement. Because as a C# developer, hey, you know, this variable's going to stay here. So we have a sub-function here called chew. And it could actually reference the time to wait variable, which... you know, which shouldn't really happen, but this works. And so what you should do is try to declare all your variables at the very top of the function. Nothing's really magic there, but it helps not only you, but a developer later in the future to realize, okay, if the variables are way at the top, then I can access them at a lower level, and that's okay. And that kind of makes more sense to our background. So that's kind of a best case. There are some other reasons I'll show you in a minute where you could get into some crazy situations if you did what I just did. But so the best practice is put all your variables at the top of your function. Because there's something called variable and function hoisting. And this is a totally new concept if you're just a C# developer. So let's look at this piece of code. And it's kind of like the one we showed similar. We're in a function. Say hello to Carlos Ray Norris, which actually happens to be Chuck Norris's real name. So if you didn't learn anything, you learned that. So we're going to say hello and pass in first name, middle name, last name. We'll concat them, and then we'll say, okay, is it Carlos Ray Norris? And if that's the case, then you know we'll say hello, Chuck Norris. But the key thing to point out in here is someone's declaring a variable inside this if statement. Now, doing that doesn't break this code. It'll work just fine, but behind the scenes, this is what's really happening. So JavaScript hoists variables to the top of the function. So what really happened is before when we had var nicknamed Chuck, JavaScript behind the scenes saw nickname being defined here and hoisted it all the way to the top of the function and set it to undefined. It does that behind the scenes, and it keeps the assignment where it was, which is in the if statement, but it actually declares it higher up. So even if you don't declare your variables at the top, it's going to do it anyway. And so this code actually works if I coded it this way or the other way. But just imagine if you had something like this. you had a nested for loop, both using the same variable I. Now, this actually doesn't work in C sharp. C sharp is smart enough to figure this out. But if you run this in C, this is an infinite loop. Because what happens, or in this case in JavaScript, it hoists the variable I, and each one reuses it over and over again, because it's not constrained to the curly braces. And so you can get into some really confusing and strange behaviors. And I mean, you'd probably hit your head over this for a while. Here's an even worse example. Let's read this from top to bottom. So we're going to console some variable. We haven't defined it yet, so it makes sense that's undefined. So we go to the next line, and we define some variable to 42. And this is actually a global variable, so anything could access this, if you're familiar with global variables. And global variables are attached to the window object. So I could say window.sumVariable, and it would still be 42. So in this case, I log some variable. Hey, I get 42. Well, all this makes sense to me as a developer. I haven't defined it. It's undefined. I define it. I have a value. Now, later in the code, I call a function called doSomething. We'll go up to the top. The first thing we do inside this function is to console that variable that we were playing with up here. And it's undefined. You're like, what in the world? Like, this should be a global variable. Anything should be able to print that out. Why in the world is it undefined? And that's extremely confusing. Like, I would imagine it would print that out. And so you're like, okay, well, it's undefined, so let's give it a value again. So then you print it out, and you're like, whew, okay, well, this makes sense. I gave it a value. It has a value again. And then you go to try to print out the global variable, and its value is still 42. You're like, what in the world? I thought I just assigned it here. So what really is happening is somewhere, just imagine this is deep down in your code. Some person, maybe not yourself, has a block, and they thought they were defining a local variable inside those parens with the same name. So since JavaScript hoists that variable, what happens is it took that declaration way down here in the if statement, and it hoisted all the way to the top of this function, and it set it to undefined. So that's why when we tried to log it out for the first time, it was undefined. And so, I mean, this is extremely confusing code. And thankfully, the way to get around it is to always declare your variables at the top of the function. Because if you don't, JavaScript will do it for you, and you'll want to hurt something. Unfortunately, functions are hoisted differently than variables, and this is another confusing thing. And there's probably, I'll explain why it's done that way, but let's look at this code and see why we might want to bang our head against the wall. Okay, so I have a try-catch here. I'm going to try to say hello, and I get an error. Obviously, I haven't declared the function, and so obviously it doesn't work. And then I say goodbye. And that actually does say goodbye. You're like, why in the world does this function work, but this one didn't? I haven't declared either of them above it. Okay, well, so this brings us to the point. There's actually two ways to declare a function. One's a function expression, and one's a function statement. If you look on the web, you probably see a lot of people using function statements. Either way is fine. But what a function statement does is it not only hoists the declaration of the variable, but it hoists the assignment of the function as well. So what happens if we actually looked at how JavaScript interprets that is it will host both of the functions to the very top of this main outer layer function. So both of the functions were declared at the top. And it actually hoists the function declaration, or the assignment as well. So it shoved say goodbye way to the top since it was a function statement. But if it's a function expression, since it really is just a variable, it kept it where it originally was. So that's kind of a confusing thing. The reason I think this probably happened is because a lot of beginning material, you'll see people just use the function statement, and they just want to write their code anywhere on the page, you know, on the top, on the bottom, and it works because it hoists both of the things to the very top, and it makes it available to everyone. So there's a slight difference. If you always use the function expression, then you could always remember the same rule as variables. It just depends, but knowing the difference could save you a lot of dismay. So again, and I'll keep repeating this over and over again, try to declare all your variables at the top of your function. It'll alleviate a lot of headache. And understand the difference between function statement and function expression hoisting. Now this next point is slightly, if you're not familiar with the concept of closures, you might not still understand it after I talk about this. It's one of those things that sometimes it takes hearing it over and over again, or making mistakes and then realizing, oh, maybe I should use a closure. And so we're going to briefly talk about it because it can be useful. You could actually do some closures in C# using the functional stuff, but I haven't seen a lot of people using it. So here's a simple use case that you might see in JavaScript or using jQuery that might have confused you in the past. And I've seen numerous developers come to me with this problem. So let's say you have an unordered list, and you want to build up a list of 10 list items in that list. And so using jQuery, this is a syntax to create a list item, and you could actually immediately assign it some properties and functions. So I'm going to give it an ID of 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 9, text with a link that says link 0, link 1, link 2. And so the developer also said, well, I think it would be cool if I had a click function that when I click the list item, it says, hey, you've clicked 0, you've clicked 1, you've clicked 2. Now, this code's broken, and it might not be obvious, but the result looks like what you want. But if you click on any of them, you get the same result, which is you've clicked 10, you've clicked 10, you've clicked 10. And that's mainly because it's not remembering. It's basically only remembering the value that it ended on, which was 10. So what you want it to remember the value at which you created the click handler. And so this is where a closure comes in. So let's do a quick explanation. Yet again, you might not still might not understand it, but we'll quickly look at it. Now this example comes from Mozilla. They have a lot of great documentation about JavaScript. I recommend going there if you haven't already. But here's a quick example of using a closure. So we're going to have a function called makeAdder, and we'll pass it a value, kind of like to prime the pump, and then we'll return a function inside that function, and we'll add that initial value to another value. So what this would look like in implementation is we're going to make an adder that will take 5 and add something to it later, and then we'll make another adder that remembers 10, and you could reuse it later. So we're going to take the make adder and pass in 2. So it remembers 5, and we're going to add 2 to it, so the result is 7. The other adder remembers 10, we pass in 2, and it gives you 12. So it's actually remembering the state. It encloses an environment that remembers the variables and the scope that happened at a point in time. Now, a visual of this, if that didn't make sense, I tried to make a picture. I don't know if it'll make any more sense. But here's our add 5 and add 10 variables. Each one points to a separate scope that has the function, which is return x and y, and it remembers the scope of that. It remembers 10. It basically enclosed itself around the value of 10. Now, the other function still has the same x plus y, but it had a scope of 5. And so, actually, I think that I switched the numbers around there, but I think you get the point. The whole concept is that it remembers what it's talking about. So the way to fix this code, it looks a little bit weird, but the way to fix it is to return a function inside of our function. And so we'll pass in what we care about, which is 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It comes in as index, and then we'll return a function that prints out that variable. And so it encloses itself around that variable at that point in time, and then when it's executed, it'll actually print out what you need. So if we were to run the same thing, you've clicked 0, you've clicked 1, you've clicked 3, etc. Now, if that previous syntax looked a little funky to you, here's another way to do it that might look a little more sane. You could actually declare your function outside. You still have to return a function from your function, but then when you actually assign it to the click event, you could do something like this, click event handler, and pass in I. So this might look a little bit cleaner to you. It still solves the problem of remembering that state. This might be helpful to you. What you could remember, even if this didn't quite make full sense, in your code, if you're running into something and it's always picking up the same value over and over again, that's probably a good case to use a closure, which is what I just said right here. So this is the last point. It's kind of a complicated one. There's no real right answer. I'm going to show three alternatives. They have their pros and cons. But a lot of C#, you have a namespace. You're used to namespaces. Namespaces are good because you could have a third-party library that comes in that defines the same class as you, and you don't want those to clash. So if you have a namespace, you know, everything's probably pretty good. But in JavaScript, it just seems like a lot of people don't realize that you could use a namespace, which you need to do because you'll run into a lot of problems if you don't. So here's a bad example of a lot of code that you might see, different examples. One is just declaring a variable somewhere. It's great that you put var in it, but it's still global scope, which means anybody can access it anywhere. Also think if you use any plugins or add-ons for your browser, well, they're running JavaScript as well. So your code could actually be clashing with one of your plugins, and so, which is a very bad thing. And I've seen a lot of code break on websites because, oh, someone has some plugin they installed. And so it's important to namespace your stuff. So this is not a good thing. Definitely, if not saying var is even a worse thing, you always want to say var. Having a function at the top level is also a bad thing. That's kind of the old school way of doing things, just putting a function out in the middle of nowhere, because that's on the global scope as well, which could conflict with plugins, with other people's code. Now, you'll see some people try to be clever and, like, prepend their function name with, like, you know, my company _ really bad way to do things. And actually, I won't mention that, but I've seen some pretty high-profile code that will try to use that approach. And so both of these functions, like I said, they're global. Like, I could say window.oldschoolway, and it would work, which is really bad. You don't want to do that. So you might say, well, what should I do? Well, the easiest way, I'm going to show, I think, 3 or 4 solutions. The easiest way is just to use an object literal. And we kind of showed this before, using the literal syntax to create an object. You just do a curly brace, put your properties in here and your functions, just like I had a person with a first name and say something. This is called an object literal. And then you treat this variable as your namespace. And so now you only have one thing in the global object, which is, you could say, window.skillet. But then you have all your internals inside of there. So you could say skillet.ingredient. It'll print out bacon strips. You could fry your bacon. And then everything's public. There's no private parts of the skillet. Everything's public. And due to the dynamic nature of JavaScript, you could add new properties after the fact. So now I have 12 pieces of bacon. You could add functions after the fact, like a toString or what have you. So that's probably one of the easiest ways that you could limit the number of things in your global scope. It's okay to have like one or two, but you definitely don't want to put everything out there for everyone to use. So the pros of this, it's cleaning up the global namespace. You're not putting a bunch of junk up there. But let's see, the syntax is slightly foreign to you. Now, if you understand JSON, this is different than JSON. This is an object literal. But if you're familiar with that type of syntax, this looks familiar. You have a colon, a comma. So that might be familiar. It's still kind of weird. It's not what you're used to, like what equals in a semicolon. So you might not like it for that reason. But it does solve the problem of cleaning up the global namespace. Another con is everything's public. There's some things you might have that you don't want other people calling. In that case, there's some other alternatives, and this is one of them. So this is the other extreme. We were all public properties and functions, and now we're all private. So this is a technique. It's a very big term, self-executing anonymous function. There's actually other terms that describe this, but essentially, I'm creating a function that has no name, and I'm calling it right away. So I'm declaring a function that has no name, and I'm calling it right away, right here. So the code in here is only executed once, and the cool thing about it, it's nowhere to be found. Like, I can't access this at any point in the future. Which is maybe what you want, because I'm not assigning it to any variable, and there's no way to call it again because it doesn't have a name. So in this case, ingredient and fry are totally private. I call it here, which, you know, it'll say frying bacon strips. But after that, I can't access it off the window. I can't fry it, or anyway, it's just a one-time thing, which sometimes that's what you want. But that seems a little extreme. So what's a better way? I like this one a lot. It's called the revealing module pattern. And this uses the idea of closures, which is what we kind of talked about remembering the state of your object. So we still use the anonymous function that calls itself immediately. So you'll see that same syntax. I have a function here with no name, and I'm calling it immediately. But what you'll see I'm doing here is I'm storing the result of that into Skillet, which is essentially my namespace. The cool thing about this is inside my Skillet, I'm declaring a pub, which that's short for public. And I'm making an empty object. So anything I add to this empty object, like pub.ingredient, that will be public. If I say pub.fry, give it a function, that will be public. So those are public things that I could call at a later point. Now, if I don't append it to pub, like if I just say, hey, I want a variable of amount of grease, and I want some private way to do something really cool down here, and I'm not appending it to pub, well, those will be private. Now, only things internally within here can call those things. So this public function could actually say I'm frying bacon strips. Actually, I should have said how much, but this could have access to the private property as well. So you're frying one cup of bacon, which sounds really good right now, but... let's see. Oh, I think I had some code down here. Yeah, so just to prove, I do have access after the fact to the ingredient and to fry. And the good thing about this, I could still add functionality to that. I could add other properties that weren't initially defined. But if I tried to declare a new function that referenced something private within it, it won't work. So... This method right here won't work because it's trying to be clever and print out something that was private, and that just doesn't work. So the pros, you now have public and private parts, which I think a lot of C# developers didn't realize you could do in JavaScript. Now, obviously, the syntax is a little bit different than what you're used to, but once you get used to just the anonymous function that runs immediately, it's not too bad. Another pro of it is the code looks a little more friendly. Like, you don't have the crazy colons and commas everywhere. You know, you have semicolons, just like you're kind of used to. So it feels a little bit nicer. The con by it is you can't take the Skillet and then add private parts after the fact. Now, if you want to do that, you'll do the last technique that I'm going to show you. And this last technique is commonly used for JavaScript libraries, where you want to maybe have some functionality in one script file, but then in another script file, you want to build up that library even more and reuse that namespace, and maybe still have some private parts of that one. And so just imagine a library that's really huge and you want to modularize it. You know, think of big libraries like, I won't call them out, like jQuery UI. Really, there's lots of little pieces, but, you know, they minify them all and combine them for your convenience, but sometimes you don't want everything in jQuery UI. So So let's look at this, and this is probably the most complicated, and I've actually added some things in it that are actually kind of cool. So we still have our anonymous function. You'll see I'm actually passing something into it this time, which before I did not. So actually, you can see I have three parameters. I have the skillet, which is, you know, our namespace. I have a dollar sign, which is jQuery. And I'm passing in undefined. Let's get back to that in 1 second. So when I call that anonymous function, I'm passing in this crazy looking code. And really, honestly, the first time I saw this, I'm like, what in the world is that doing? But this goes back to our falsy values that we talked about at the very beginning of this slide deck. It's really important to know those six falsy values. So what this is doing, for the very first time, it'll say, hey, is windows.skillet, is it null or undefined or, you know, empty string? And if it returns false, like if it's never been defined before, it will default itself to a new object. And so what that does is now we have a brand new object for skillet, and within here we append our public things to it. So that's kind of cool. And with the dollar sign, the reason we did that, we're actually passing in jQuery here. Now, this is a friendly way to play well with other libraries, because other libraries like to use dollar sign too. jQuery is not the only one that likes the dollar sign. So by using this technique, you're passing in the full word jQuery. But when we reference it inside of this technique, we could actually use our favorite little dollar sign and use that to our heart's content, because it's less typing and whatever. Now, the third parameter, we never passed. We never passed anything down here. There's no comma and something else. So in JavaScript, you know, there aren't really signatures that you're used to in C#. You could pass anything you want to a function. And if you don't pass something to it, but you reference something in the parameters, it gets defaulted to undefined. Now, why would I be setting undefined to something that's undefined, the word undefined? Well, unfortunately, ECMAScript 3, undefined is not a reserved word. So some really mean person could redefine undefined to true, and it would mess up all your logic because, like I said, there's those six falsy values. And so what we're doing here is protecting ourselves against someone malicious or someone who doesn't know what they're doing. And so we're guaranteeing that if we use undefined inside this block, it's always going to have the value of undefined. Just a little trick, but it works. And so the syntax in here should be very familiar with all the other examples. If you want it to be public, you append itself to the namespace. If you want it to be private, you just, you know, don't append it to skillet. So the value of this, you still have public and private parts, just like the previous one, but you could do this concept again. So here, down a little further, we use the same technique. Now this, the one that we looked at before, imagine this is another script file. Well, it will look at window.skillet, and it says, oh, I already have that. It's defined. And so it will use that, and within your code, it will build up that namespace together. And you could actually, unfortunately, I didn't do this, but inside of this block, you could have another private function or private variable, and it would only be accessible to the public parts. So this is a way you could build up your libraries over time. And if you were to look at, append to the company I work for, we launched a library called Amplify. We use this technique internally to build up. We have three components. Each one uses this technique to build itself up together. So I know that took a long time to explain, but there's really no perfect answer. It's, you know, weigh the pros and cons for your situation. If one seems kind of daunting and overbearing, use the object literal. Use something and protect yourself from other code, either in the future or a third-party code. How much time do I have? Okay. So this one has tons of pros, the public and private. The syntax is easy to look at. You're protecting yourself with jQuery and other libraries. You protect yourself against the undefined thing. There's just a lot of goodness in here. It is slightly more complicated, but not too much more than some of the other ones I showed. And that's basically describing that there's no one perfect answer, but just protect yourself. That's the idea. So thankfully, there's a tool that pretty much finds everything I described here and will tell you what you've done wrong, which is good because that's probably where you're thinking, like, oh my goodness, my code's probably doing these things. And so I have a file with a compilation of all the bad code that I showed in this presentation, and I'm going to stick it in this tool. Oh, actually, I love this. There's a warning called JSLint will hurt your feelings because it's kind of brutal. So Douglas Crockford wrote this tool, and it's really good to pinpoint some problems you might have. There's a lot of options you could turn on and off, but let's just run this real quick. So some things it found right away is like, oh, you know, you probably should be using the not double equals instead of just the not equals, because we don't necessarily want to coerce the values. We want to be sane at the end of the day. And then, let's see, a lot of those. On the new object, he's like, you know, you probably should look into using the object literal notation syntax, which is the open curly and curly. Same thing for the new array. He's like, you know, you probably should think about doing that differently. Where is one? Yeah. This one's kind of confusing. But remember the four in array? The description, if you understand what it's talking about, then it makes sense. But it says the body of a four should be wrapped in an if statement to filter unwanted properties. What that means is check the has own property. So it's actually doing all this stuff for you, because probably you don't want in MooTools, for example, you don't want all those functions to be bleeding through in your for statement. So fortunately, there are JSLint's been around for a long time. There are tools that can integrate with, you know, your editor of choice if you want to, or you can integrate with your build. There's actually a fork of JSLint called JSHint that has some additional options if you don't like this one. So there's JSLint.com or JSHint.com. Either one's a very valuable tool. So I recommend you to do those. So you might thinking, okay, well, that's a lot of things. Are there any other things I need to know? Well, again, Douglas Crockford, he's an architect at Yahoo. He wrote a book called JavaScript, the Good Parts. A lot of the things in this presentation were gleaned from his book. If you want more patterns, like the ones I showed at the end, there's a great book called JavaScript Patterns. There are some great articles on Script Junkies that gets into this series. And actually, Julian Bucknell, he works for DevExpress, he wrote a very long series of JavaScript for C# programmers, and I recommend that as well. If you don't like to read, or don't know how to read, I don't know, there is a video series on Yahoo by Douglas Crockford, and there's like 6 videos, they're like an hour long each. And it basically has all the content from his book, and it's very deep, and you learn a lot. And thankfully, someone transcribed the thing into text. There's slides, there's video. So I've watched them, and then I go back and I search the text sometimes if I want to remember something. It's on slide deck. You know, there's a lot of ways to get that material. So again, I'm Elijah Manor. I hope you learned at least one thing that you could take away. If there's any questions, get a microphone. And please fill out your evaluations. I would appreciate that. Thank you. Yes?
What's the importance of the open parentheses before the function keyword?
Oh, like the way instead of putting it below?
Well, you open the paren, then you say function, and then you finally execute a function, and then you close the paren on that.
Oh, the self-executing one?
Right. Like, yeah, this is perfect.
Like here?
Yeah.
Well,
at the very beginning, before.
Oh, at the very beginning.
The first character, yeah. Before the word
yeah,
function.
I think if you, it's kind of a way to make the developer realize, hey, something else is going on later in the code. It's kind of to be helpful for the next programmer to say, hey, this is not only a function, but it's like doing something special. And so it's a way to kind of make them think, oh, this might be executing itself. And so it doesn't have to be. It could be. I think it could be an exclamation point. Facebook does that. But this is kind of a common approach to use this syntax anyway.
Okay.
Thank you. And if there are no other questions, I'll be up here afterwards. You're welcome to come up and ask questions. Thank you again.